This part of the program is brought to you by St. Peter's Healthcare System, treating you better for life.
Once again for Heartbeat. Heartbeat is an educational program about your health, which airs on EBC Radio every second and fourth Saturday of the month. We're also live on the web, www.ebcmusic.com. I'm Dr. Dinesh Singhal. I'm an interventional cardiologist. I'm the director of the catheterization laboratory at St. Peter's University Hospital and an attending cardiologist at Robert Wood in New Brunswick and Princeton. Have offices in Somerset, Monroe, and East Brunswick. And for any new listeners, we've been bringing this show to you for over 15 years now. Hope you enjoy it and encourage your friends and family to listen. Today, we're joined in the studio by Dr. Philip Pankari. Dr. Pankari is a hematologist, oncologist, and is a member of the Regional Cancer Care Associates. It's a large group in the New Jersey area. And we're going to talk today about a topic, and if I look back, I don't think we've discussed in all the 15, 16 years we've been doing the show, and that's about bone marrow transplantation. As always, for a regular listeners, it's going to be like a class. You're going to learn a lot about what bone marrow transplantation is about. And during the show, if someone has any comments, questions, they want to share their experience, the phone number in the studio is 732-297-9886, 732-297-9886. So with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Pankari to the studio.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Let's just start with some very basic stuff. Bone marrow transplant. What's transplantation in general?
So transplantation in general, when we talk about bone marrow transplant, it's a bit different than talking about what people normally think of when they think of transplant, which I think is commonly solid organ transplant, where people have, you might have a kidney transplant or you might have a heart transplant. Bone marrow transplantation essentially refers to basically giving a dose of chemotherapy or radiation that's enough to sort of ablate or significantly reduce the amount of cells in the bone marrow. We do that in order to control or to cure diseases, malignant diseases typically, of that bone marrow, like leukemias and lymphomas and things like that, which would otherwise be incurable or difficult to control without doing the transplant.
So we're going to step back a little bit and get to some of the basics. So let's just also help everybody understand what is bone marrow. Which parts of the – obviously it's bone and there is something going on over there. So
right. So the blood is – the blood is made in the bone marrow. And the marrow is sort of the soft component within many of the bones in your body where your blood is actually made. So it's primarily in the bones of the pelvis, and sort of the hip bones. It's made, in a great proportion there. It's also made in the sternum. It's made in several of the bones, in the spine, also in the ribs. So that's really the primary site where the bone marrow is. And when I refer to making blood, what I'm referring to is really all the components of the blood. So there are white cells in the blood which fight infections. There are red cells, which you might hear somebody refer to hemoglobin or a low hemoglobin or anemia. And when people talk about that, they're talking about basically the red cell component of the blood. And red cells are necessary to deliver oxygen from the lungs, where they pick up oxygen to all the tissues throughout the body. And then the third major component of blood that's made in the bone marrow are the platelets, and they clot the blood. They keep people from bleeding, if you have a low platelet number, you're more likely to bleed, or you're more likely to have excessive bruising. So all of those components are made in this bone marrow that's largely within the sternum in the middle of the chest and the hip bones, all with the soft part within the hard bone.
Now, what's the life cycle of these cells? And I guess it'll be relevant because later on you'll discuss that. So when a cell at the end becomes a red blood cell or a platelet or a white blood cell, it obviously didn't just, like any plant or some other product which grows out there, it just doesn't come out like that. So where does it start?
So and that's actually very important to the discussion. So there's something called hematopoietic stem cells in the bone marrow, and these stem cells are.
So I'm sorry, but hematopoietic, these are cells which are just dedicated to, when you say hematopoietic, this is related to blood
only
cells.
Only blood.
So these cells are somehow genetically designated to eventually lead to blood cells.
Exactly. Right. And by stem cell, they can become any type of blood cell, but they are already dedicated to becoming some type of blood cell.
Right. So to clarify, every tissue in the body, whether it's a heart cell, whether it's a brain cell, whether it's a muscle cell, at some point at its origin had a stem cell.
Yes.
Which was programmed to eventually translate and become a certain cell of that particular tissue.
Exactly.
And so the ones which are geared to just make blood cells are called hematopoietic stem cells.
Yes, right? Exactly. And that cell is what the whole idea of bone marrow transplantation or stem cell transplantation revolves around. The idea of this stem cell that, via a very complex combination of signaling within the bone marrow that's very complicated and it's only incompletely elucidated so far, is made to ultimately become the white cells and the red cells and the platelets, all coming from one original hematopoietic stem cell.
So when, in other words, if somebody's cells are not good, which means that they have now leukemia, which is affecting the cells, you have one choice in a rudimentary fashion to replace those cells by putting new white cells or platelets or whatever, or you can put in new stem cells so that now the cells which they will form will be healthier and won't be diseased like the ones which existed in a diseased fashion.
That's in large part the idea.
Right. Yes. So when you're doing transplantation, you're actually putting the precursors of these N cells, the stem cells, somehow new stem cells, so that the line which they create will be cleaner than what was there before, which was diseased.
Yes. Yes.
And now I just want to also help people understand the distinction between what's unique about the blood cells as opposed to other tissues. Now, our body is made of variety of organs, and they have their own tissues. When I'm a cardiologist, when someone has a heart attack, the cells get damaged permanently, and there isn't the ability for the heart to just generate new cells. While it sounds like the bone marrow is unique in certain ways, where it's not just one a certain set of cells which are the only cells which exist when we are born, and they just continue to regrow. So, just kind of separate that out with tissues which are not regenerating of sorts, and the ones which are regenerating like this, so people understand that, why this helps as opposed to some other tissues.
Yeah, so long as you have these hematopoietic stem cells in the bone marrow, there remains the ability to replace all the elements of the blood. Even an otherwise quite damaged bone marrow, if you have healthy stem cells, it retains the ability to recover.
So in other words, there are certain tissues which, if they are they don't replenish themselves, while the blood cells kind of keep replenishing themselves.
Yes.
And so other than even transplant, just again to go back to the marrow, people sometimes, what does it take to have a healthy marrow? Because there are people who I see sometimes will have so-called dysplastic or marrow which isn't functioning well. So are there certain components or what makes a marrow healthier than others? Or
so it, I think there are two primary factors. One of them is exposure. So some patients have sick bone marrow because of having, you know, been exposed to certain chemicals or even certain chemotherapies in the past, which can have long lasting effects on the cells in the bone marrow. And the other thing is, you know, there are primary diseases that extend into affecting the sort of early, very immature white cells. So you mentioned, you know, a disease called myelodysplastic syndrome or MDS. I mean, that's a characteristic condition where these cells, when they're early in their development, there's a mistake in their development so that they don't mature normally. And that process going from stem cell to mature, you know, red cell or mature white cell is interrupted by this process where they don't grow up into a functional cell. They actually become, the name dysplastic is actually in the word, which means that you can see them looking deformed under the microscope because they've failed in that process toward, differentiation and to become a healthy, normal adult cell.
You're listening to Heartbeat. This is EBC Radio. I'm Dr. Dinesh Singhal. I'm talking to Dr. Philip Pankari. He's a hematologist-oncologist. Our discussion today is broadly about bone marrow transplantation. The phone number in the studio is 732-297-9886, 732-297-9886. When people suffer leukemia, and we'll take that as an example, which part of that cell cycle is being impacted? Is it the stem cells? Is it the cells at the end? What really happens to that patient in leukemia or lymphoma?
So in a condition in leukemia, the defect is typically somewhat after the stem cell stage. So it typically takes place, you know, one or two steps beyond an actual pure hematopoietic stem cell. So these cells have already committed to become white cells. And you know, in the case of a certain type of leukemia called a myeloid leukemia, they've already committed to, you know, the type of cell that fights bacteria. And in the case of a lymphoid leukemia, they've already committed to the type of cell that fights, you know, viruses and things. But it's once they've already made that initial dedicated step that then the mistake happens in their further maturity, and that's how you develop the leukemia from that point forward. I think it's important to mention that, you know, when we talk about stem cell transplant or bone marrow transplant. And they're really, I think the distinction is one that, that is often confused. When we talk about stem cell transplant and bone marrow transplant, they are nearly the same thing for clinical purposes. The objective of both of them is to put healthy stem cells back in the marrow. The difference in terminology, arises based on where we're getting these stem cells from. If we're going directly into the bone marrow and taking the bone marrow out of a patient physically, like in an operating room and draining bone marrow out, you know, then it's called a bone marrow transplant. In the case, stem cell transplant is a broader term that also encaptures a more modern and convenient way to get the stem cells from the donor, which is to collect them from the blood. So now we have ways of sort of inducing the bone marrow to sort of spit out these early stem cells that wouldn't normally be in the blood and collecting them from the blood. So somewhere along the line, you might hear, you know, the term stem cell transplant used more often than bone marrow transplant. And that's because stem cell transplant encompasses both, you know, donors who gave their actual bone marrow and donors who gave stem cells that were in the peripheral, you know, circulating in the blood. But in both cases, the objective is to put those hematopoietic stem cells into the marrow, a damaged marrow or an empty marrow where they'll be able to mature and sort of repopulate with all the normal elements of the blood.
So when we talk about leukemias and I guess I'm coupling lymphomas at the same time, I'm assuming there are different kinds depending on a variety of factors, right?
There are, and they're actually treated very, very differently. So I think that to take this even a step of complexity further, there are two broad categories of stem cell transplant. There's something called an autologous transplant, which is where you get your own stem cells back and there's something called an allogeneic transplant or a donor transplant, where you get cells from, you know, it's exactly how it sounds. You get it from a donor. It's actually the majority of transplants done are where you get your own cells back, and it's done for a very different reason and a very different set of diseases.
So of all the kinds of leukemias and lymphomas, let's just broadly discuss what are the variety of treatment modalities which are available, and then we'll kind of get down to which kind of people are more suitable for transplants.
Sure. Right. Sure. So, you know, in cases of leukemias, you know, leukemias reflect something having gone wrong in the maturity of the white cells in the bone marrow, as we described. And that's typically treated, you know, there are many different types of leukemia. Some of them are chronic. Some of them are acute.
What's the... For a layman, if you wanted to explain the difference between acute and chronic, what would be the how would you explain the difference?
So acute typically is more immediately dangerous and behaves more aggressively, right? And typically is treated with aggressive chemotherapy.
And the underpinning of leukemia, just again to clarify, is that the cells increase in number dramatically. They're multiplying at a crazy.
They do.
So,
I mean, basically, the bone marrow, instead of producing in a controlled manner, you know, a normal number of functional white cells, it sort of spins out of control. Is I think a useful way to think of it, and starts producing many, you know, more than it should, white cells which are not functional, which actually, instead of doing their normal job, they sort of, you know, collect in places and sort of wreak havoc and act in ways they shouldn't act and secrete chemicals into the body that they shouldn't be secreting. So that's the leukemia picture. It begins in the bone marrow. Lymphoma refers to the cells which fight viruses that are also made in the bone marrow. But those cells called lymphocytes sort of patrol throughout the body, and they're in the lymph nodes, sort of little, you know, what sometimes when people refer to their glands, you know, right. They mean lymph nodes in the neck, and they get big when you're sick.
Right.
And what that is the lymphocytes in these lymph nodes trying to fight infection. So when lymphomas develop, they often develop at a site outside of the bone marrow cavity. They often will develop in a lymph node, you know, somewhere in the neck or somewhere in the abdomen or in the chest. So both of these conditions, aggressive leukemias and lymphomas, you know, they're treated with a variety of therapies, but very often, you know, we could sort of group them linguistically into, chemotherapy is what we can call it for the moment. So frontline is usually to try and control the disease with chemotherapy, and then the bone marrow or stem cell transplantation part comes in, you know, if that's by itself not enough.
And so, what are some of the downsides of chemotherapy?
So chemotherapy is, to talk about chemo, let's talk about traditional, what people usually mean when they mean chemo, not the newer targeted pills and things like that.
Yeah.
But chemotherapy basically it was designed in recognition of the fact that cancer cells divide a lot more quickly than normal cells in the body. So for cells to divide, they have to sort of, reproduce at certain intervals because they have a limited lifespan. So they produce these son or daughter cells. And in the case of cancers, a trademark of cancer, especially things like lymphomas and leukemias, are that the cells reproduce at a very rapid rate. So chemotherapy was designed to basically interrupt cell division and stop cells from being able to divide. So by its very nature, cells which divide much more quickly than other ones are going to be affected much more by chemotherapy than normal cells. That said, normal cells are still affected to whatever extent they're still dividing. So that's why you see patients who have, hair loss and stomach issues while they're on chemo. And that's because the cells in the scalp that produce hair and cells in the stomach, and they turn over very often. They divide very often. So in doing so, they're more vulnerable to chemotherapy. So side effects are, you know, as most people are familiar with standard chemotherapy are, appetite problems and nausea, you know, basically stomach problems, occasionally vomiting, hair loss. fatigue. And I think, for the sake of our discussion, a very important side effect to talk about is that chemotherapy for any condition has effects on the bone marrow's ability to make cells. So, it affects your red cells and your white cells and your platelets whenever you give chemotherapy for any condition, leukemia, lymphoma, or, you know, breast or lung or colon, whatever cancer you're treating. Chemotherapy is going to kill also cells in the bone marrow, which are trying to divide and make blood.
So the big challenge is that once the drugs go in, they're unfortunately not able to most of the times distinguish and go at the cells which really need attention, but they kind of go in indiscriminately and go into tissues where you don't want them to go.
Exactly.
And impact the cells. And that's why, you know, patients who are on chemotherapy, as you pointed out, lose hair and, their cell counts go down because, these drugs are affecting areas where you don't want.
Right.
And so I'm sure, like anything else, there has been an effort to find targeted treatments so that they impact only the cells which are diseased and not just any other tissue in the body.
Yes, and we're making a lot of progress in doing that. If you look at the state of oncology today, virtually every disease we treat now has some form of targeted therapy or immunotherapy available that we're using in combination with traditional chemotherapy. But there is still very much a role for traditional chemotherapy, especially for cells which are, very aggressive cancers with high rates of division.
So we'll get into the specifics of how transplantation is done after the commercial break, but what are some of the... the whole premise of transplantation, was it just so that you can prevent damage to other tissues, or was there some other reason why transplantation even came to fore as a treatment choice as opposed to chemotherapy?
So in a nutshell, the self-donating type of transplant, what I called an autologous transplant, is effectively a way just to give people a very large dose of chemotherapy to try and cure diseases which are not curable with normal doses of chemotherapy, and then sort of saving or rescuing the bone marrow afterward by giving the patient back these stem cells. So, I've heard a lot of patients actually, I've heard a lot of doctors who work in that subspecialty, and including myself, sort of push a little bit to change the name of an autologous transplant to something called a stem cell rescue. The other type, the donor type, is as you alluded to, is very specifically to actually replace their whole bone marrow with somebody else's immune system.
But in either case, even in the first case, where what you're doing is you're destroying the existing bone marrow, basically cleaning house of sorts, doing spring cleaning, and then you've taken the stem cells ahead of time, which are good. You park them somewhere,
yes.
And then you're saying, okay, I'm cleaned house, now I'm just going to pack them up with new cells. And so the whole purpose of transplantation, I would assume, is a more permanent cure than just dealing with the after effects of bad cells just coming and you're knocking them off.
Right. So to talk about the autologous transplant where you get your own cells back, we often use that to treat diseases like lymphoma and myeloma that are responding very well to chemotherapy, but just incompletely. So a lot of these patients simply need a much higher dose of chemotherapy than we can give them without destroying their bone marrow.
So we're actually ready for a commercial break. So we're going to be back right after this break. This is Heartbeat. This is EBC Radio. I'm Dr. Dinesh Singhal. We're speaking to Dr. Philip Pankari, who's a hematologist-oncologist. Our phone number in the studio is 732-297-9886. We'll be right back.
EBC Radio would like to thank St. Peter's Healthcare System, treating you better for life, for sponsoring the preceding program of Heartbeat Show.
An estimated 160 million Americans are either overweight or obese, which can lead to hypertension, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and other health risks. The Bariatric Center at St. Peter's University Hospital helps adults identify and establish healthier lifestyle changes to lose weight. Treatment options include bariatric surgeries that are clinically proven to help adults lose weight successfully and transform their lives. The weight loss specialists at St. Peter's University Hospital, treating you better for life.
You're listening to EBC Radio. This is 1170 AM. Program is Heartbeat. I'm Dr. Dinesh Singhal. I'm an interventional cardiologist. I'm joined today in the studio by Dr. Philip Pankari. Dr. Pankari is a hematologist-oncologist. He's a member of the Regional Cancer Care Associates. It's a large practice in the New Jersey area. And our topic today has been bone marrow transplantation. We kind of set the stage to help you understand why, in some cases, we would need a variety of forms of treatment, including bone marrow transplant. And in this half, we'll kind of get into the nitty-gritty of how it's done, what are some of the downsides and upsides, and the various kinds of transplantations. If you want to share your experience, comment, question, phone number in the studio is 732-297-9886, 732-297-9886. Okay, so as we were talking in the break, there's a couple of different, broadly, different kinds of transplantations based on where we're getting the tissue from. So what are the, at the top level, what are the different kinds?
Yeah, so there are two primary types. One of them is where you get your own stem cells back. So what effectively happens is the stem cells are collected. They're typically collected from the blood. Basically, we give patients an injection of a drug which tells the bone marrow to sort of send these stem cells out into the bloodstream where they can be collected, and then they're put into the freezer. For lack of a better word for it, they're basically frozen, and they sit there and they wait until they need to be used for the actual transplant. And the idea behind doing a self-donor transplant, where you give your own stem cells and then get them back. They're basically these are patients who have diseases that are highly responsive to chemotherapy. So typical ones treated with the type of self-donor transplant are certain types of aggressive lymphomas, disease called multiple myeloma, another bone marrow disease. And these diseases are often highly responsive to chemotherapy. However, if we use normal tolerable doses of chemo, the type of the doses of chemotherapy you can give somebody and then send them home afterward to continue living their life, the diseases are not cured by that. So let's say you have a lymphoma and you give somebody chemotherapy for 4 months and the lymphoma comes back, right? It responded, but it just came back afterward. You know then that simply giving more standard dosing of chemotherapy is not going to cure that lymphoma. It might not get back again, but it's sort of, you know, we've already tried this and then it came back. So for that patient, we collect their stem cells, we put them in the freezer, and then we admit them to the hospital and give them a very, very large dose of chemotherapy over several days. The rationale being, and we know that this is often true, that chemotherapy is killing, standard dose chemotherapy is killing, 90-some% of the lymphoma cells, but to wipe out the remaining few, you need a much higher dose. So this very large dose of chemotherapy is given to the patient. And that's where the stem cells in the freezer come into play, because if you give a patient that dose of chemotherapy and then do nothing else, it would obliterate it. It would destroy all of their bone marrow cells, and they would never recover their red cells and their white cells and their platelets. So then, after this big dose of chemotherapy, what we do to sort of rescue their bone marrow and help them to regenerate their whole immune system and their blood is we thaw out their stem cells that are then in the freezer and reinfuse them. So the idea behind a self-donor transplant is effectively just to be able to give somebody a much bigger dose of chemotherapy to try and cure or control a disease than you would otherwise be able to, because it would be too toxic for the bone marrow.
So if you take the example of this lymphoma patient, then I would assume that in most instances you would give them the routine dose of chemotherapy and then see if the problem is cured or not. And then if it comes back is the time when you want to do, have this high-dose chemotherapy with rescue reimplantation of the stem cells.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's exactly how it's done in Hodgkin lymphoma and many types of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. It's done exactly that way. You try first to cure it, and if it comes back, then you know you need to do the stem cell rescue.
So just ballpark, what percentage of patients who initially present with a lymphoma of this nature wind up with recurrence and then need transplant?
So, there are many different types, sure. But I think if I take the most common type that we treat with a self-donor transplant, it is probably a disease called diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, a common type of aggressive lymphoma. We think about 60% of those patients are cured with the initial chemotherapy. And then the other 40%, these are very rough numbers, but the other 40% or so will have the disease come back.
But because lymphoma, then it means is a big word, which right. underneath has a variety of kinds, just because somebody has a lymphoma doesn't necessarily mean that 40% of them will need transplants. There may be some lymphomas which lot of cases can be just treated with chemotherapy.
There are lymphomas treated with chemotherapy, treated with targeted pills, and there are lymphomas that never need to be treated because they're so tame and they grow very slowly.
So in other words, if somebody hears the word lymphoma, they shouldn't assume that this doesn't have a treatment which can be cured in one go.
Not at all. There are many different types.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And then what is the other kind of transplantation we're talking about?
So the other kind is for diseases where we know that no matter how high a dose of chemotherapy, even if we give them this protector stem cells in the freezer and give them this massive dose of chemotherapy, even that won't cure some diseases. And we know that those diseases are, the high risk types of acute leukemias. If you've heard of a disease called AML or ALL, not to get too detailed about them, but certain types of very aggressive leukemias, myelodysplasia or MDS, which is basically a sick bone marrow condition. In these conditions, no amount of chemotherapy is going to cure them. So, by that very fact, doing a self-donor transplant would also not typically cure or not be expected to cure these diseases. So the reason to do a donor transplant is sort of twofold. On the one hand, it's a similar idea in that these patients also get a big dose of either chemotherapy or radiation, which basically is going to wipe out their bone marrow the same way as I described with the self-donor transplant. But the other component is that then you're infusing not the patient's own cells, you're infusing somebody else's stem cells. And the reason that the patient's original malignancy or cancer was able to exist is because at some point it evaded that person's immune system. So, cancers, when they start out, they should really be stopped by the patient's immune system when they're a cell or two thick. I mean, they should be detected and destroyed. So in order for a cancer to become a clinical problem, to actually become a diagnosis, somewhere along the line, it has escaped the notice of that patient's native immune system that's supposed to catch it. So the idea is if you go give this big dose of chemo and radiation, and then you put in another person's immune system. So for the little bit of, let's say aggressive leukemia or something that's still left in the body after the chemo and radiation, the hope is that this other immune system that's not native to the patient's body will detect the residual disease and destroy it in a manner that the patient's native immune system failed to do. So the donor transplant is actually the first type of immunotherapy. I mean, we hear about, in oncology, it's going in this direction where, instead of chemotherapy and targeted therapies, a lot of newer treatments are basically turning on the patient's immune system to help it fight the cancer. Well, in this case, donor transplants are basically putting in somebody else's immune system to fight any remaining, microscopic cancer that might be in the body. So it's an immunotherapy is really what it is.
So the decision whether it's the individual themselves donating their own stem cells as opposed to getting that from someone else is really driven by the kind of leukemia or problem they have. And not so much that one's failed, then you pick up the other one. It's just the nature of the leukemia itself.
I would say the great majority of the time that's correct. Usually we know what type of transplant we're giving somebody based on the type of disease that they have alone. I should mention that in some lymphomas, it's not too uncommon that if they get a self-donor transplant and it comes back yet again, occasionally then we'll try the donor transplant. But.
You're listening to Heartbeat. This is EBC Radio. I'm Dr. Dinesh Singhal. We're talking to Dr. Philip Pankari. He is a hematologist-oncologist. Our discussion is about bone marrow transplantation. Our phone number in the studio is 732-297-9886. When it comes to a donor transplant, does the person have to be related, or can it be some stranger off the road?
Right. So that brings me into kind of the risks of doing a transplant as well. So we prefer that the patient have a matched related donor. So the ideal donor is, you know, a patient's sibling. If a patient has, you know, a brother or a sister who's a match, but the patient, you know, that person has to be an actual match, right? And
the matching is not just blood group or something. There's more to it than that, right?
So they look at it. It's not blood type at all. Actually, the blood type, believe it or not, does not need to match. It's actually something called HLA antigen, certain proteins on the surface of the stem cells. And they predict, whether the new, immune system is going to mesh well with the patient's other organs. So if we put in the wrong type, or if, you know, sort of the more mismatched the new immune system is compared to the patient's old immune system, the more likely the new immune system is to actually attack certain parts of the patient's body. So we call that graft versus host disease. And that's a condition where the donor cells can actually, you know, in a confused way, not realizing that they're attacking, you know, the patient's own body, you know, have effects on the bowel or on the skin or on the liver. So we like the related donor if that's an option, because, you know, a perfectly matched, you know, sister or brother is the closest thing we can find to the patient's native immune system. So the odds of a bad reaction, so to speak, are lower. That said, there's a huge registry of patients who have volunteered. I'm sure that, you know, everybody has seen sort of advertisements and you know, the ability to sign up as a potential stem cell donor. There's a huge database of people all over the world who are in this you know, who have sort of volunteered to be a donor if they need be. So for these patients who don't have a matched sibling, then we turn to the database and we see if they have a match in there. And then there are even different degrees of match. I mean, there are people who have 10 out of 10 of these HLA antigens matching. There's 9 out of 10, anything below, you know, and then they're even half matched. And, you know, the more unmatched a patient is from their donor, the higher the risk.
Let's get into the mechanics of how actually the process works. So what is involved in someone donating, whether it's the individual himself or herself and or a donor? What's the mechanical process? How does that work? Is it an office, a hospital? What are you actually doing?
So it had been that a patient, you know, for the longest time, where it was only, you know, if we collect the bone marrow directly, that patient is sedated, brought to an operating room, and manually, the doctor goes in there and just manually removes with a needle bone marrow from the hip. So they go into the hip bone and they just remove it. Because of convenience and some other, you know, there are some benefits and drawbacks to using bone marrow instead of cells from, you know, stem cells circulating in the blood. But for various reasons, it's becoming more and more common now to simply collect the stem cells from the blood, which is, that process is not entirely simple, but it involves for about 5 to 7 days giving patients an injection of a drug that basically pushes the bone marrow to force these stem cells, which usually are only in the marrow, forces that to push them out into the bloodstream so they can be picked up by a catheter is put into the patient's neck, and then these cells are collected by a machine. So I would say the majority of donors now, the process they go through is a series of injections under the skin, and then they're hooked up to a machine for 1 or 2 days, which collects the stem cells from the blood.
And so this is done in a hospital setting?
Yeah.
So the patient's staying in the hospital for anywhere from 2 to 5 days or something like that?
So actually, if we're collecting them from the blood, Patient can often take the injections at home, and then we can collect it in the clinic, of the hospital, usually a bone marrow transplant clinic. They would come in, and it looks a lot like being on dialysis for a day or two, actually. They come in, they're hooked up to a machine, and their blood circulates through a machine. And what that machine is doing is filtering out, you know, the actual stem cells and taking them.
So the only invasive part of the process is that catheter, some tube which is put in the neck vein.
That's exactly right. And the, you know, the injections give people some sort of what I like to call growing pains. I don't know how accurate that is, but sort of cramping. It's sort of the bone marrow. It's very intuitive, I think. The bone marrow is being forced to, you know, make all this extra blood and work very hard to push these stem cells out. And there can be some cramping pains associated with that.
So the process would be similar if the person's doing it on their own or if a donor is giving it?
Yes, same process. They're pretty much identical.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm just going to handle this now. When a donor gives a certain tissue, for example, if somebody is being a kidney donor, they're actually losing a kidney by giving up a kidney. But in this instance, just like donating blood, and the blood is kind of remanufactured, so you're really not losing something permanently. Is it the same kind of process where the person's donating part of the bone marrow, but really nothing, not losing anything as a donor in the long run?
We believe there are no long-lasting effects. As we mentioned much earlier on, you know, the patient has the ability to regenerate the stem cells which have been lost. Basically, what ends up happening is the bone, you know, any effect on the bone marrow is reversible, and the patient ends up having a, you know, they should, what does happen if you watch their blood work is, you know, their white cells may go up a little bit during the process, but if you check a week or two afterward, everything should be normal again. So it's not like giving up an organ.
Got it. So now, so this was the donation piece. And let's talk through how it's infused back into the body of the person who's affected.
Yeah. So, you know, that part is rather extensive. The patient is admitted to the hospital. At least if we're talking, let's talk about the donor transplant. There are a few exceptions with the self, transplant, but, the typical experience for somebody undergoing a donor transplant for, let's say an acute leukemia is they'd come into the hospital and they'd plan on being there for something like 30 days. Right. And that can vary widely. Some people leave after 3 weeks. Some people are there for 5 or 6, depending on how everything goes. But at minimum, I tell people 3 to 4 weeks they should plan on being in the hospital. And they come in, they're admitted, and they start what we call the conditioning regimen. And what I mean by that is just chemo and or radiation. You know, they get the chemo and the radiation to sort of clean out the bone marrow. And not only clean out the bone marrow, but also try and kill any remaining disease, you know, leukemia, lymphoma, whatever we're treating that might be left. And then after they've gotten all of the conditioning chemotherapy and or radiation, then the stem cells are infused. And, you know, if the product is frozen because let's say it's an unrelated donor in another country, then it's sort of warmed up in the room and it's pushed in, it just pushed into the patient's blood. It goes in like any other drug through an IV. If it's a fresh product, it's in a bag, it hasn't been frozen, it's hung up and it drips in. But, you know, it can look and feel very much like getting a blood transfusion, but in fact, it's much more significant than that. And from the point of stem cell infusion onward, it can take, you know, basically the patient needs to be in the hospital because all their numbers, their white cells, their red cells, their platelets are all very low after getting all this chemo and radiation. So we keep them there until the stem cells, you know, that are put right into the blood, what they do is they hone in on the bone marrow. They find the bone marrow, they settle in there, and they reproduce, and they fill the bone marrow with this new population of it basically regenerates the entire organ. And the patient's ready to leave the hospital when we see all their blood counts coming back up. So, and that's a reliable indicator that the stem cells have found their home and they're working.
That's fascinating. How can, you know, you infuse them in a vein in the arm, and these cells know where to go.
They know where they're supposed to go. Yeah.
Wow. And what's the, so are there, other than the, so the side effects of this infusion would be related more to the chemotherapy than to the adverse effects, unless it's, you know, like if it's a donor's cells which are not matching, or there's right. some problem with the person they donated to. In most cases, it shouldn't be that is not the big problem. The problem is related to the chemo and the radiation.
Absolutely. And in the short term, yes. I mean, for the 30-day hospital stay I'm describing, side effects and any complications or difficulties come from, you know, the big doses of chemotherapy and radiation. The part where the donor cells can start to attack, you know, this graft versus host phenomenon I mentioned, which is donor cells attacking the body. If that happens, that usually happens a bit later. It can happen by, you know, at engraftment. So it can happen as the cells are beginning to come up, but more commonly it happens, you know, months, you know, a month or two down the line. And we take precautions. I mean, we don't sort of cross our fingers and hope that this doesn't happen. Patients get immunosuppressives. They get things to subdue that new immune system from attacking things it shouldn't be. And then, you know, over time, those medications are tapered down and ultimately taken off.
And what's the success rate of once you give a transplantation? What's the likelihood that whatever your goal was, which is really to clean out and put new stuff in, would persist? And if it doesn't work, why won't it work?
I mean, I think it depends. I think that question really would have to be tied to a certain diagnosis, because the outcomes are just so widely and dramatically different depending on the disease. You know, if you're talking about an acute leukemia or a myeloma, they're very
different. Let me rephrase the question. What proportion of patients who you give this treatment, just broadly, if you had to explain mm-hmm. to someone it would work? I mean, going through this whole exercise, yeah. Does it work most of the times? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we define working by, you know, the stem cells find their home and they reproduce a normal immune system and the patient leaves the hospital and gets back to their normal life, I mean, without regard for whether the patient is ultimately cured or not, I'd say about 80% of people, you know, a year later are you know, alive and well. So.
When you're looking at the quantity of the of what you have to draw out and what you have to infuse, mm-hmm. is it a pretty standard process, or does the amount you draw out or the number of cells varies from treatment to treatment? How do you know how much to infuse?
Yeah, so it's actually, the number is in the millions of stem cells, and it's actually quite standardized. It's okay. There's a minimum that we need to hit for everybody. So.
And is there a certain age group where this is not indicated, transplant in general?
Definitely. So we know that, you know, there's sort of the trend in medicine is to view more the patient's physiologic age rather than their, you know, chronological age. But that said, I mean, if you look at the studies and the data, sort of patients who are very elderly, what we're always afraid of or sort of cognizant of not doing more harm than good with a lot of these procedures. So, you know, toxicities are a little bit more significant, and engraftment rates and rate of, you know, complications are worse in patients when they, you know, if you transplant somebody who's in their 80s compared to somebody who's in their 40s. So, you know, you would see, especially in the case of donor transplants, it's not a hard cutoff, but usually when you get above 70, we start thinking that this might be a little bit risky. But again, that's a soft cutoff.
So. Well, Phil, thank you so much. You know, the hour just flew by, and it was a pleasure having you here. And as always, I learn a lot when I have these conversations. And I'm sure our listeners probably had a much better feel on how transplantation works.
Sure.
So really
WWTR Bridgewater.
EBC Radio would like to thank St. Peter's Healthcare System, treating you better for life, for sponsoring the preceding program of Heartbeat Show.